Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
Hey, it's Radio Mysterioso. It's one of the few...
This mic is up. There we go.
It's one of the few cold openings I had in a long time. It's because I want this interview to go well. It's Radio Mysterioso for November... What is today? What is today, Dr. Taff? 27th, 2011. I don't even know what day it is. I'm going to switch over here and put Dr. Taff on. As promised, Dr. Barry Taff is on with us today. And maybe I'll read the regular bio here. Actually, one of the listeners asked if I would have Dr. Taff on, and I thought, hey, great idea. I've wanted to talk to him for years, and gives me a great excuse. Off his bio, Dr. Taff holds a doctorate in psychophysiology with a minor in biomedical engineering. He's a world-renowned parapsychologist who worked out of UCLA's former parapsychology laboratory from 1969 through 1978 as a research associate. During his 43-year career, Dr. Taff has investigated more than 4,500 cases of ghost hauntings, poltergeists, and conducted extensive studies in telepathy and precognition, which led to the development of the initial protocols and methodologies for what was later termed remote viewing. He was investigated himself as a psychic subject in 1969, the results of which were published in Behavioral Neuropsychology there's a range of dates here, April, December 1974 through January, March 75. One of the cases Dr. Taff investigated in 1974, and which we will talk about, gained international fame as the book and motion picture The Entity, starring Barbara Hershey, which was released by Fox in 1983. He served as technical advisor on The Entity, as well as being represented in the film by the character of Gene Kraft. He's got a note here that Entity, or whatever it was, followed its female victim for quite some time after the initial investigation. Dr. Taff has appeared on numerous TV and radio programs, including, I'm not going to list them. I hope you, do you forgive me?
I forgot them. I already forgot what they were.
Yeah, CBS News, KNBC New, KBC News, Ghost Caught on Tape, blah, blah, blah. And the Sci-Fi's Channel Unknown Encounter and California's Most Haunted, which were the highest rated shows in Sci-Fi Channel's history, for which he served as creating consultant and technical advisor. I saw one of those while I was writing Weird California, and it caused me to write the chapter on The Entity, which ended up in the book. He's been consulted for government, business, and law enforcement, including the CIA, Office of Naval Intelligence, National Security Agency, Defense Language Institute, Defense Intelligence Agency, DARPA, FBI, Interpol, LAPD, California Highway Patrol, Santa Barbara Sheriff's Department, and Westminster Police Department. He's also served as technical advisor or script doctor on the films Logan's Run, wow, Demon Seed, Altered States, Poltergeist, and The Entity. And his new book, which I just finished reading, is called Aliens Above, Ghosts Below, Explorations of the Unknown. I think that's it. I've read most of the whole thing. Welcome, Dr. Taff.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. But Greg, I have to ask you,
sure,
your opening, who is that? Is that from the beginning of Plan 9 from Outer Space?
Yes, it is. You're the second guest that's recognized that.
Yeah, it's rather depressing to think some of us really remember that stuff. I grew up on sci-fi. That was some of the worst of it, but it was so bad it was good.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's why I like it. You know,
I mean, I remembered it. That was Criswell, right?
Yeah, the Tim Burton film captured it perfectly, and I'm glad that film came out. I mean, that's exactly how I always thought about that whole crowd.
Yeah, that was the good old days when they made movies for nothing. Well, they still make movies for nothing. It's called Paranormal Activity, except they make a lot more money.
Yeah, exactly. If only.
Yeah. But I was just curious, as I remembered it, and I said, yeah, Plan 9 from Outer Space. And that was, I mean, it was, if Bela Lugosi died during the production, and they had to replace him with a friend of his doctor, I think.
His chiropractor.
You could see that he's... That's why his face wasn't visible after a certain point, because he wasn't the same man.
Yeah, Wood just said, hold this cape and run your face, and nobody will notice. It was Dr. Tom Mason. There you go. Now I win on Jeopardy, right?
Yeah, amazing. it's kind of sad to think some of us would remember this stuff, but...
Well, a lot of people know about it. I mean, because of the film, and also before that, because of the Golden Turkey Awards thing by the Medved brothers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how I found out about it, and then he became a hero of mine because he did such terrible stuff, but he was so dedicated, and we all know about him now. If he hadn't been in that book and hadn't been so terrible, we would have never heard of Ed Wood.
Right, exactly. No, we don't know who's he.
Yeah. So is there anything you want to add to that introduction?
No, I just wanted to make sure that's who it was. I haven't heard that segment or that sequence of that... the audio
opening
track in a long time, so I was just curious.
Yeah, well, it sets the tone for this show. I mean, we like to talk about this stuff, but if we take it too horribly seriously or make too much fun of it, it's just, you know, I try to keep it light and easy, and of course, as you've already noticed, conversational.
Right, which is important.
Yeah. God, should I start at the beginning?
Sure, you've got to start
somewhere. Yeah, everybody, I try to keep away from these, where did you get started? Maybe I'll twist it a little bit, and everybody knows you as a parapsychologist. Some people even think you have a degree in it, but I don't think anybody actually offers a degree. Well, I guess a couple do.
The only person I know of on the planet who has a degree in parapsychology is Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove. That was UC Berkeley. He got that in the mid-70s, I think, and he had to work a lot longer and harder, and I mean, he did an incredible job. He did the work of maybe 4 or 5 PhDs, but I don't know what good it did him. I don't know him anymore. I barely knew him to begin with. I sort of thought he was like a distant acquaintance. And but he's the only one I know who got a doctorate in parapsychology from an accredited institution like one of the UC campuses.
Yeah.
It's like getting a degree in witchcraft. What can you do with it? Who's going to hire you?
Yeah, I do not know, and I've heard his name for years, but I don't know what he did with it either, besides be a parapsychologist. So, according to your degree is in...
Psychophysiology
and a...
Biomedical engineering.
Biomedical.
The interrelationship of the brain, of the body, the behavior. So it's the cheap man's route to medicine. Instead of learning diagnosis, and prescription, you learn form and function. So it's neurology and physiology and neuroanatomy and neurophysiology and electrophysiology and psychophysiology. It's all that combined, and it's you learn more about how the body works the way it does and why versus how to diagnose and prescribe.
Oh, okay.
And the reason I didn't become a medical doctor is I'm very sensitive to people's physical pain. I'm what's called a medical intuitive, and even when I was very young, this was a problem, and it's more so a problem now. And I would have, my bedside manner might have been atrocious because, well, how am I today, doctor? And I buckle up in pain and I fall over, so that wouldn't have been good. And so I decided to stay away from treating people who were ill because I'd be feeling ill all the time.
Have you been that way?
Medicine, a lot of my, you know, like the contemporaries who did become MDs, not parapsychologists, but MDs. MDs, the insurance, the liability insurance, and all they have to deal with, a lot of them walked out of, let's say, Los Angeles because it became too expensive to work here. Now the insurance, it's horrible. No one ever thought it would turn into what it has. So
yeah, I had a friend that was a clinical psychologist, and he said half to three quarters of all his work was just covering himself, documenting everything, and doing all the paperwork. Mm-hmm. And this was in Delaware, so.
Yeah, malpractice insurance is gone through the roof.
Exactly.
It's very bad because, you know, HMOs and all they've done is raise the price of everything and make everything more complicated and diminish the quality of care to people. The saying is we have the best medicine money can buy, and unfortunately that's true. So in the end, we're kind of trapped between a rock and a hard place. And, sometimes I think I should have become an MD, but I just was too sensitive to people's pain, so I couldn't have lived with it.
Is that what steered you into the parapsychology stuff, or did it grow out of your doctorate program?
Well, the interests were multifaceted. One was curiosity. And the other was, growing up, I had a lot of psychic experiences, which I still do. Some are volitional, some are spontaneous. And I thought, how come I'm having these experiences, my friends and family are not? And so I said, well, either I'm crazy, everyone else isn't, or they're crazy and I'm not, or it's somewhere in the middle where I'm having these interesting experiences, and why am I having them? So telepathic, precognitive, out of body, why are these things happening to me? Why aren't my friends all describing similar things? I may never know that, but that's what got me motivated. And ever since I was a kid, I've had these experiences, and I thought, wow, this is interesting. So I want to understand why they work and how they work and why they work with some people yet not others. And we've come a long way from what it was when I got into the field almost 43 years ago. But most of it is still unknown. But we know a lot more, where some of it is predictable to a point, and some of it's almost demonstrable, except the theories suggest a reality far different than we've been grown up with. The real world at this level may operate in an entirely different way. We're used to the world working in a very pragmatic, physical manner, and there seems to be things that go beyond that, which dictate many aspects of this field. And one of the reasons science has ignored it for so many years is because there's no model that can explain it. There are models, but they make us, we have to revise our version of reality or our concept of
it. I'm very happy to hear you say that, because I keep saying that about a lot of these strange things that the thinking has to accommodate, like you said in the book, your theory has to accommodate the data, and sometimes the data pushes you in an area that a lot of people are uncomfortable with. What you described, I think, a little bit, the parapsychology lab at UCLA. I'm amazed there was such a thing. So maybe you could describe how it was started and what experiments conducted, etc.
It started long before I knew it was there. A woman by the name of Dr. Thelma Moss. She used to be an actor, and then she met her husband, got married, and had two kids. Her husband died. He was an actor and a producer.
Uh-huh.
And when her husband died, she went back to school, got a doctorate in clinical psychology, and she had a strong interest in this area, and she began doing research in it, got a lot of attention because she was a woman, for one, and because very few people at that time were really involved with it at the level she was. And she was a very, very unique individual, and she was a very dedicated person. But she was a clinical psychologist, and that was it. She didn't have a knowledge of medicine, per se, or of electronics or biophysics or anything like that. Her job was to look at this from a psychological perspective, and she investigated a number of areas. And I met her. I actually wrote her a number of times at her office at UCLA, 1968 or 9, and she never responded. And then I met one of her graduate students when I was in college. And he said, sure, do you want to meet Thelma, Dr. Moss? Sure. So I went to her house. She lived not far from me in Beverly Hills. And I went and sat down next to her, talked to her, and about my experiences. And she got kind of bored. And she threw me her keys and said, what do you pick up? So I held her keys, and I described some things. And I said, who's this fat blonde lady named Shelley? Blonde hair, blue eyes, really loud mouth, kind of obnoxious. That was her best friend. It was Shelley Winters.
Yeah. Yeah.
So certainly an unflattering description, but nevertheless accurate. And I told her other things that I obviously had no way of knowing. And so, you know, I became her psychic pet and worked in the lab as a research assistant. And she ran a study on me as a psychic that was published, as you said, in a medical journal. And, okay, so you're psychic. Okay, well, why you? Why not your friends or family? Why? And with me, it was multifaceted. Different types of things were going on. and okay, the study's published, and some of the data they collected, not the parapsychological data, but the physiological data, was so bizarre or enigmatic that the journal refused to publish it. They said the machines must have been in error or been broken because they didn't believe it. But here we are decades later, and so, okay, so you're psychic. Oh, wait. Instead of, but what does it tell us about? It just tells us nothing.
Yeah.
So that's what got me into it. And then, of course, as a kid, I was reading books on the subject by Frank Edwards, Stranger Than Science, Stranger Than Fiction, Stranger Than Strange.
Yeah.
He wrote many books, and a lot of them dealt with the paranormal and in it, all its manifestations. And I was fascinated, and I go, well, this is really intriguing. Every culture on Earth reports the same things, but no one's doing anything about it. No one's actually doing hard research in it. Well, because you'll be ostracized, and people will think you're crazy, and you'll lose your job, and you won't be able to earn a living. And so I got into this, and I was a lab rat for Thelma, for Dr. Moss,
huh.
Her psychic pet, and okay, great. And, and then I became a research assistant and a research associate, and the rest is history. So I did work in the lab. We did work in telepathy and precognition, which turned into the initial development of the remote viewing protocols, which worked very well in some people and not very well in others. A small percentage of the people we saw were amenable to training and could actually develop this like you develop muscles for sports or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, you know, I wouldn't bet on their ability to do anything in this area. That was great in the lab. We learned things that were extraordinary. The evidence suggested that our notion of time and space is wrong when it comes with this, deals with this. There is no energy going out. We're not sending a wave or a beam or a particle with anywhere. If you're in China and I'm here in Los Angeles and we're able to communicate telepathically, there's no wave between us. It's not energy we know of. It is not electromagnetic. It is not nuclear. It is not gravitational, which leaves us with nothing.
Yeah.
But the model that works is a hologram. If you have a normal 8x10 photograph, you cut it in halves or quarters or eighths, you get a half or quarter or an eighth of the photograph. That's the nature of regular photography. If it's a holograph, a 3D image made by laser light, because of the equally distributed information and the way it's made, each piece can recreate the whole, albeit with lower resolution, smaller the piece. And there's evidence our brains work like this. There's evidence consciousness works like this. There's evidence space-time works like this. So what I'm suggesting here, based on the evidence, is that the past information still exists, the future's information already exists, and the information of things remote from us is everywhere. Basically, everything is everywhere. There is no time, there is no space. When it comes to this process, this mechanism, we're wrong. It's not like the electromagnetic world we live in right now. And this portends an entirely different reality, where we may not have any more control over our future we do over our past, but in the future doesn't exist. The information about it exists. The same way the past doesn't still exist, but the information about it still exists. That's what we're accessing with our minds.
Mm-hmm.
And, so you could theoretically be on the moon. You could be in another solar system. I mean, we can't prove this, obviously, but I have the gut feeling that we're looking at Gip ghost in the mouth here. We're being shown something extraordinary, and instead of trying to explain it based on what we know, it's by a process of elimination and more research, people just want to ignore it because they don't want it. It's too difficult to deal with, so they ignore it.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of ignoring going on with some of this. There's in fact, I get emails from people from last. I had Richard Senate on. He said he knew you and to say hi.
Yeah, I know Richard. I've known Richard a long time. Nice guy.
And the
great story. He has one of the most impressive voices I've ever heard, and certainly storytelling. It doesn't get better than him. He's a very gifted conveyor of information and knowledge, and I really like the man, but his voice and his ability to communicate to people is extraordinary, and it's great that someone like him is around doing the work.
Yeah, well, he's a historian, so I think he's a very good voice for this kind of stuff. You know, literally, as you said, and figuratively, because he can tell the story properly. So I had his show on, and I got a couple emails from people. One of them was, you know, why do you listen to people that make up stories like this? And the other one was, this guy hasn't found any proof of anything for 25 or 30 years. Why is he even doing it anymore? And I'm sure you get that all the time, speaking of that subject.
Not quite the same thing. I've run across, after 43 years of work, enough evidence, which some of which is in my book, some of which is not. In terms of the lab work, the laboratory work, it's overwhelming. I mean, we did this week after week, year after year, and it was very consistent. The work that got me going, though, was the field work, investigating cases of poltergeists and hauntings and doppelgangers and apparitions.
Right, which we are going to talk about.
Right, and then, as we will see later on, before the show's over, that we've had cases that began as poltergeist cases and evolved into an alleged UFO abduction.
Yeah.
What began as a UFO abduction evolved into a poltergeist case, which is not that uncommon, apparently. So
no, it's
the question
not.
Is, what is it telling us about the nature of the phenomenon? And that's where my interest still is. And like I said, we've learned a tremendous amount of information, patterns that have stood the test of time, and it's getting, I have to say this with all due respect to everyone else doing this, it's getting so predictable at this point, it's getting a little boring. It's not like some of the cases are the same, they're all the same. The faces are different, the locations are different, but the evidence collected is the same. We're learning the same things from every case, and there are certain patterns or commonalities that seem to be very consistent. And if you would have told me this 30 or 40 years ago, I would have laughed at you. I would have said, get out, come on. And the most important thing for people to understand is, let's focus on the field research, the poltergeist, the ghost stuff, the apparitions. 99.99999% of the people that have recurring experiences with this tend to be either seizure-prone or epileptic. Real simple. Now, it doesn't mean you have grandma's seizures. You could be seizure-prone, you'll never know it. It could be very subtle, a sleep disorder, and you may take a medicine that, like Klonopin, which is anticonvulsant, but a lot of the people that have these recurring things around them tend to have, in terms of the physical phenomena, tend to have this neurological problem. However, most people who are epileptic or seizure-prone are not poltergeist agents. So there's something in the middle, a missing or unknown variable, we don't know what it is. We also now know that we didn't know 40 years ago that the location is critical. It seems that electromagnetic and geomagnetic anomalies seem to drive or trigger the nervous systems of people who are hypersensitive to this, and that coupling between them and the environment helps trigger these events. And if this is true, and the evidence suggests it is, that we could reverse engineer this and we could make it happen rather than wait for it to occur, but that may not occur in my lifetime because it would be way too risky. Be playing havoc with the environment at potential harm of other people, and you never do that.
Yeah, I brought this up with Richard Sennett. I said I think it was Dean Radin when I was talking to him, and this was years ago, I interviewed him, and he said, what I wish that we could do was get some very sensitive instrument, like a random number generator, for instance, and put it in, without anybody knowing it, into a mental health facility and let it run for a while and see what would happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's fairly well established that certain individuals, by their very presence, cause random event or random number generators to go out of randomicity. And why this happens, no one knows. Like I said, the forces we know of, and there's only four or five in the universe that we're aware of, don't seem to be at the root of this. The only force I would describe is I call the zero-point field or the zero-point energy. Unlike the energy we know of, it is not exothermic. It is endothermic. It doesn't produce heat. It may take heat out.
Yeah.
And and the mechanism by which it couples to us appears to be magnetic, but the phenomena in itself, the force that produces these events, is not magnetic. But that seems to be a coupling that allows our bodies to couple with this other force. And it's amazing because we take out instruments on cases. Well, we haven't had a case in some time, but we have a suite of very, very sensitive engineering-grade instruments, and we've seen very good, collected a lot of data over a great deal of time, and it's amazing the consistency of it. And the bottom line here is that without living people, nothing happens. we can't prove or disprove if there's discarnate entities out there, intelligences like ghosts. If we survive corporeal death, I suspect it might happen. It may happen. We can't prove or disprove it. The evidence suggests that basically there needs to be a living person in that environment before something occurs. In my book, I describe people, these unique individuals who were hypersensitive to these environments, as biological operational amplifiers, BOAs, not Bank of America. In electronics, there are operational amplifiers used in circuitry.
Mm-hmm.
And this, we may be doing the same. We take the energies there, we absorb it, we reshuffle it or we modify it, and we re-emit it, operating as a focal plane and a waveguide. And the question is, if this is the case, then we might be able to artificially drive the process. And what I mean by this is, you know, if you close your eyes and put a strobe light in front of your eyes, it'll cause your brain waves to react. That's called photic driving.
Yeah.
There may be a way to drive physical phenomena instead of with light, which still is electromagnetic, with lower wavelengths of electromagnetic energy, lower frequency wavelengths, longer wavelengths.
Oh, yeah, you did bring this up in the book. You talked about ELF waves that supposedly came out of the Soviet Union.
Well, it's ultra-low frequency and extremely low frequency, which our bodies emit continuously. And what's intriguing on the cases we go out on, the instruments we have can measure electromagnetic and geomagnetic and ionic and all this sort of stuff, but we can't measure biomagnetic. Biomagnetic would require superconducting sensors, squid devices, and those are not handheld because they're supercooled. However, around poltergeist agents, these very unique individuals, their bodies are emitting over a million times the biomagnetic field amplitudes they should. Instead of producing microgauss that we can't detect with our instruments, these very unique and special individuals are emitting in the gauss region, over 5 gauss.
Uh-huh.
That's impossible, but
yeah,
it happens.
It means they're a magnet.
So what is that telling us? Pardon?
It means they've turned themselves into electromagnet, apparently.
Well, something akin to that, yeah.
Yeah, something like it.
And so that's the coupling mechanism, and no wonder why they have seizures and they can't sleep and they have take their medicine. And the question is, a lot of the people I've dealt with over the years, they said, you know, it's odd, when I stop taking the medicine, the seizures go away. So does the phenomena. When I stop taking the medicine because it doesn't make me feel good, the seizures return and the phenomena returns.
Yeah, I've ran across that in your book too. This is a friend of mine a few years ago. He died of cancer in the late 90s. Mario Pozzaglini, he was the clinical psychologist. He used to study people who said that they were getting messages from somewhere and would write them out. What essentially we call alien writing. And he said he had a Amish child that was having seizures and episode of seizure-like symptoms. And he said that in addition to this, he was channeling and speaking in Old High German, which is a language he said the guy had never heard of, and he spoke it quite well. And he said that he left this child in the care of at some facility, and he told them, do not medicate him. I'm doing fine without the medication. Don't medicate him. And he said, as soon as he left, they medicated him, and all the channeling and everything stopped.
Yeah, because that part of his brain was shut down by control by the medication.
Yeah, and it was just interesting to me over these years to hear some of these parallels coming out. Another interesting thing in the book, and you've already started bringing up stuff that is in my question set here, and we can explore these longer. I mean, you don't have to give me the what's it called? What everybody wants, which is the soundbite version. We can go on at length. The thing that fascinated me, one of many in the book, was the issue of geomagnetic forces and tectonic strain and other issues like that may be a factor in the hauntings and poltergeist cases. And you mentioned a little bit about the correlation. Is there any way you think that this might work, like a working model, a mechanism,
example,
or is it just proximity?
We had a case in 1976 in Hollywood on Hollymont Drive. And the house is still there. There's still things going on, but at a much lower level.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that house.
And now we know, which we didn't know back in the 70s, that it sits almost on top of the intersection of two active earthquake faults. Okay, and there's a shallow river running under the house, which we didn't know back then as well. What a surprise. The old entity case, 1974, Culver City.
Uh-huh. Which
we
will talk
know
about.
That the house sits in the midst of a very geomagnetic, geophysically active area, and the ground is granite quartz, hot piezoelectric.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of activity in there. What a shock. Another case, 2005, 2006, down the road from where the Sharon Tate murders happened. It's a geomagnetic anomaly site acknowledged by the U.S. Geological Survey. Our instruments went crazy there. We were there 16 times. I got sick there 16 times. I stopped going because I couldn't afford to go to the hospital anymore. And we had some extraordinary experiences there. And I don't know if the place is haunted, but I know that the geomagnetic environment is such that it wouldn't surprise me. And this is why people get sick, and there's strange electronic phenomena and disembodied voices and, you know, luminous anomalies. And it seems that this seems to be a recurring pattern where we look at the environment, the geophysical environment, and we see this commonality, this consistency that, you know, there is this pattern. And so that means that the vents are the result of a confluence, not an influence, a confluence.
Mm-hmm.
Location, 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 unique individuals, and the emotions of the people. It's amazing. And if you draw back with a broad enough perspective as you analyze these cases, you see a pattern again that's indicative that this is related to the people living there. Let's see. In the entity case, Doris Beither, we met her on August 22nd, 1974. It's chapter two of my book, The Real Life Entity Case. We met her. The very first thing she told us, that she'd been repeatedly raped by a ghost. We went, oh. Rolled her eyes back and thought the woman needs psychiatric intervention. And there's nothing we could do, and we left. Anyway, about a week or so later, she called back. Some friends and neighbors witnessed stuff, so we went back to her house, and my colleague and I are standing in the kitchen talking to her. A lower cupboard door flew open, and a skillet flew out, an iron skillet, taking a parabolic trajectory across the kitchen, landing where there were no springs or wires or children or animals in the cupboard. And over the course of time, the bedroom was always ice cold, yet it was a very hot August. We were there, very muggy, very humid, and the bedroom felt like it was refrigerated. It was a horrible stench of decomposing organic matter, which we could never determine the source of. And over the course of time, we saw the lights, and in the book, we did capture one example of them, and you see looked like a ball of light with a tail on it, with shooting very high-speed black and white film, no digital back then.
Yeah.
And then the main photo of Doris, which she's on the bed cowering with the lights, that was, you see the arc of light over her. What's really important for people to grasp here is that the walls behind the arc beat at a 90-degree angle. Had the light source been projected against the wall, the light would be bent in accordance with the wall, but it was not. So what the light we were seeing was in free space. Now, we never saw arcs of light. We saw light zipping around Doris, always lime green in color. And what we probably ended up catching was a time lapse. We weren't shooting fast enough, exposure time. So if you take pictures of the stars at night and leave your camera open long enough, you get a streak.
Yeah.
Unless you have a motion platform, a motor mm-hmm. platform. So that's, we've got a time lapse because we weren't shooting fast enough. What's interesting, though, is that in the third photo of the sequence, you see these arcs are 90-degree angles to each other, and the negatives in the camera were analyzed by the West Coast editor of Popular Photography, Adrian Vance, back in 1976, and he can't imagine how these pictures could have been made, because he said the very nature of SLR cameras would have prevented this from occurring.
Yeah.
So. Anyway, so at one point, we're in her bedroom. We were there over a 10-week period, and the lights, these lime green, larger, weren't orbs. These were large. It looked the size of two large male fists. They were huge. They all converged in the corner of the bedroom, forming a large apparition from about the waist up. And this was a very, very tall image of a man. It was three-dimensional, lime green. It was articulating. It looked around at us, and then it just popped out like someone turning off a light bulb. and we all wrote down what we saw before we spoke about it. We all saw the same thing. Must have fired off 50 or 60 frames of film, and nothing showed up on the film, which makes no sense because we could see this. It was lit up the room. We could see each other. It was still bright.
How many people were in the room for this one?
Probably about 20 to 25 people.
Yeah, I remember seeing on the documentary that there was a cinematographer, at least somebody that taught it at USC. And
Mort Zarkov was there.
Oh, right. Was he really? Because I think that one of the programs there is named after him.
Mort Zarkov was he taught at USC Film School. He was also a writer and a producer. He used to work on It Takes a Thief, a lot of shows at a Universal. Really nice guy. And he helped Frank DiFilippo try to document this. And it was very difficult because, you know, the phenomenon had a mind of its own. It did what it wanted to. One night we did get a ball of light. And the problem is we couldn't tell where it was coming from or going to or the speed at which it was traveling. We had no reference. So we covered Doris's bedroom walls and ceiling with black poster boards and duct tape, forming a grid pattern. And in each square was a magnetic orientation and a number. So we thought we'd have a reference. The problem is we couldn't get any more photos of the balls of light. So one night, about 1 in the morning, we had a call from Doris. We go running back to her little house in Culver City, and all the boards have been torn down along with the plaster and the paint. And she's freaking out. She's shaking. This woman is pretty small, maybe an inch taller than me. Small, little, frail little lady. And she was very cryptic and evasive. She wouldn't even tell us her age, although we know her. She was about 10 years older than me at the time. And she could have torn it down, but I don't think so. From her, if she did, she was a great actress. She was petrified, as were her children. And eventually she moved. And she moved from Culver City to Carson. The phenomena followed her. She moved to this new little house. Her neighbors knew nothing about her or the phenomena. She didn't talk about it. No media exposure. She would have made a terrible witness for the media. And it was amazing. Within a matter of weeks, people living on each side of her in their own little homes began experiencing poltergeist phenomena of their own, which suggests the phenomena has a proximity effect or it's radiant. And then she finally moved from there to, I think it was San Bernardino or Riverside. It followed her there for a while. Then she disappeared. She moved to Texas. We didn't hear from her again until 1983 when the film came out. And that's about the last time I spoke to her. And now, accordingly, supposedly, she's passed away in 1999 of respiratory failure.
Oh. Uh-huh.
That's what one of her kids said.
Oh, okay.
So she had 3 boys and a girl. Now, it's important in this case for people to understand it. She had 3 boys, and each from a different, all her children were from different men.
And yeah, I found this fascinating in the book and what the conclusions you'd drawn between the number of entities, how they interacted with her and with the kids. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it doesn't take a psychologist to reach this conclusion. 3 male entities, 2 smaller ones, 1 big one, which is what she had with the boys, and it had a totally dysfunctional relationship with them, and the big one raped her, and the 2 others held her down. And it's just a little too projective in terms of the psychoanalytic implications here. And these types of things are also present in other cases we've had. In another case, which is 1989 and 93, with Jackie Hernandez. It's chapter 3 in my book called A Hazardous Haunting, and I worked on this case with Barry Conrad. He did a great job of documenting it in his video, An Unknown Encounter, in his book, An Unknown Encounter, The True Story of San Pedro Haunting. The reason I call it A Hazardous Haunting is Jackie Hernandez's maiden name was Hazard.
Yeah, that's right. If I remember you said
so
that.
That's very appropriate. And I have a thing with puns, you know, word plays on words. But it's interesting. I won't go into the story too much because it's why you read chapter 3 of the book. But in there, the phenomena, whatever it was, kept attacking Jeff over and over again. Jeff Wheatcraft was one of our Barry Conrad's friends and assistants.
Yeah.
And Jeff came to help us. He thought we were nuts. He was doing Barry Conrad a favor at the time. And repeated times, whatever it was, tried to kill him or hurt him. Try to hang him in the attic, which is detailed in the book. Try to throw him into the wall where the chair he was sitting in up in Weldon when Jackie moved up there, and other events. But what's interesting, I thought, okay, so the phenomena goes after him. After she visited Barry Conrad's old apartment in Studio City, the phenomena broke out there a few times. And I go, okay, this is a little odd. It wasn't bothering me, but it was bothering her, Barry, and especially Jeff. Well, it's interesting. At one point, I said to Jackie, what do you think of Jeff? She goes, I hate Jeff. Why do you hate Jeff? He seems like a nice guy. Well, he's always in my way. I go, what do you mean he's in your way? Well, she mistook Barry Conrad's help as one of romantic interests. She was estranged from her husband at the time with two kids, and she was really attracted to Barry, and Barry looks like a young Elvis, so why wouldn't someone be attracted to him? Yeah. You know, he's intelligent, he's very affable, he's friendly, successful, and so every time Barry was there, Jeff was with him, and she started to hate Jeff. Who did the phenomena keep attacking? Jeff. What a shock. And I asked her this on a show we were doing with Hard Copy, 1993. So I asked her, and so the producer says, oh, so you mean Jackie tells the ghost what to do and the ghost is doing? I go, there's no ghost, it's Jackie. What do you mean it's Jackie? It's her. And she's like, what are you talking? Okay. Then she moves up to Weldon, comes back to San Pedro to visit some friends, and she's staying in some motel, running around Gateway, comes back to her motel room, and over the walls and ceiling are the words written in big red marker pencils, words mad and angry. If you had to describe Jackie's mind at that point, her personality would be mad and angry. She was dispossessed, lost her family and home because of all these things, horrible things going on. Yeah, she was mad and angry. Of course she was. So what a shock. And she was so attracted to Barry Conrad that she broke in his apartment. He wakes up one morning and there's a new Jackie Hernandez in bed next to him.
It seems like in this work you've met a lot of unstable people just because of what you said. Seem to be the ones that the phenomena seem to gather around.
Yeah. But see, this is what I'm getting at here. If you look at these cases, if you know enough about the people that are having the phenomena around them, if you learn enough about their backgrounds and their state of mind and their psychology and what makes them tick and their neurology and the environment, it all begins to make a really intriguing picture. The picture painted is always the same, albeit different locations, different names, but it's the same thing over and over again. So how many coincidences make a fact? And my guess is, if you could do a survey, this is impossible. If you could take a survey of people that run around the world over time visiting famous haunted locations, the people that have recurring experiences at different locations versus the people that don't, the people that do would be wired in such a way their body is hypersensitive to these forces. Their bodies are either seizure-prone or epileptic at a very subtle level, and the environment is affecting them, and they trigger this result. It's sort of like, imagine a DVD player. You've got to have the DVD machine itself. It's got to be plugged in the wall. Then you've got to have the DVD in the player, and then someone's got to have the remote with a battery in it to use the device or it won't play. That's the analogy I'm putting here.
Uh-huh.
You know, the environment is the DVD player and that plugs in the wall, okay? The DVD itself is the information that's stored in that environment. The person is acting like the remote. And this is interesting in San Pedro. Jackie hasn't lived there a long time now, many years, and different families have lived there. And there's a high frequency of recurrence with the phenomena, the same type of things Jackie was experiencing. Not identical, but people move in, they move out. They move in, they move out. Similar things. And we haven't been able to go back there because the owner doesn't want us back there because he wants to keep the property quiet.
Yeah,
my guess is if we were back there, we'd measure the same geomagnetic or electromagnetic chaos we see in other places. So the phenomenon is real, it's demonstrable, it's tangible, it's measurable. The question is, without the right, I guess, parameters, nothing happens. It just won't happen.
Have you ever had... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Have you ever had anybody go in and... do a study concurrent or subsequent to yours with this on the same subjects?
mean in a certain environment?
Yeah, yeah, like at a certain location with a certain...
No. The entity, no. Most of the times, usually when the people start paying attention to it, it stops. Like, there are a few cases it doesn't, but no, there were usually, we don't have follow-up, and no one else goes in because they're so upset, they just want, a lot of them just move.
Yeah.
You know, there's an interesting saying, I've been doing this work now for 43 years, in excess of 4,500 cases, as you stated. We've had white, Caucasian families, we've had a few Asian families, we've had Hispanic families, you know, we've not had one black family ever call us, ever. And that's odd because, you know, L.A. is a great melting pot.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe it's like Eddie Murphy said, they're smart. They just get out. They leave. You know, us stupid white people, we sit there and take it, you know. But it is odd that we've never had, I don't know, I think that there was one woman who called several years ago. She's very well known, a black actress, and she chickened out at the last minute and she ended up moving. Of course, it moved with her because it wasn't the environment. It was her.
Yeah.
But I've never been out on a case with a black family. It's just strange. It's like, you know, what's wrong? Well, maybe they're the wisest of the bunch. They just leave. I'm not going to take this garbage. And Eddie Murphy said it best years ago, one of his routines.
Yeah, I remember it.
Yeah, so it's, like I said, I think we could basically drive the environment with the right people in it and trigger phenomena.
Yeah.
Okay, so what if we could do that? You're sitting there and all this stuff happening. You see apparition, things are moving around. Oh, this is, we've got it. Oh, that's it. Okay, now we know what it is. And then the apparition turns to you and goes to you, why in the hell are you doing this to me? Then what?
Yeah, well, you would hope.
What if there is, if it is sentient,
yeah.
Other than if, you know, if this is real consciousness at work of a deceased individual, which that implies survival, that's a whole different, well, what I'm saying here suggests that there's no evidence for that there may, survival, there may be no difference between living and dead when it comes to consciousness. We think there is because we don't know any better.
Yeah.
But the evidence suggests without us as people, living people in that environment, nothing happens. Period. At all. Nothing happens at all.
Have you ever had it? I think you described a little bit in here in the book. Have you ever had a case where there was some sort of a conscious, apparently
yes,
conscious source to this, where like an answer would be given or something like that?
Well, you know, the one thing that really makes me wonder, again, you know, in science, your data must fit your theory must fit your data, and that's where it is right now. There was one case in 1970 or 71. Anyway, it's in the book, first chapter. And this was in Inglewood, near the Forum. And this guy came to me named Dwayne, and he was a police officer, a young police officer, a few years out of the academy. His grandparents owned a home in in Inglewood, and they were killed in a horrible auto accident. The neighbors didn't know they were dead, and they were seeing them taking out the garbage, doing the lawn, but they were dead. So they called me in there. Went in the house and it had been unlit. The power had been turned off, and we're in there, and it everything was covered with dust except one brake front was very clean. We're walking around and we saw this, I don't know, some kind of a leather bag or something get up and go across the room on its own. So we decided to see if we could make something happen. So we had a little seance there, and trying to provoke something, and heard some strain. Now there was no water and power in the house, so we had was candles. And it was the summer of 1970 or 71. And long story short, we stop the seance. I go in the bathroom. There's nothing there. And I come out, and I see this man who wasn't part of our group, much older, khaki shirt and slacks, white hair, and he lunges at me and starts to choke me, really big guy. And I couldn't get his arms off my neck, and he threw me in the bathtub and started choking me, get out of my house, get out. And some of the guys that were with us beat him off me to the floor. He fell off me, and I got up, and my jacket was torn, my shirt was torn, my neck was very red, and we saw this elderly man just fade away. What was left beneath him was Dwayne, who brought us to the house. And what? So he comes to because they beat the older man, which I assume Dwayne got the beating. And it was amazing. We told him what happened, and he said, wait. And he pulled a picture out from a dresser, in one of the bedrooms of his deceased grandfather, and that's the image we saw attack me. He'd been dead for years.
So everybody in the room saw this person, but it
No, that's the problem. The women saw Dwayne attack me. They didn't see the grandfather attack me.
That's right. I remember this now.
So what did we see? It's like a movie. Different people see this, different things. That's insanity. In the entity case, you have 25 people seeing an apparition. They all agree on what they saw. If there is a force of energy present, electromagnetic, that's affecting the brain, that's causing us to hallucinate, there would be no continuity in hallucination. For one person, the next would be another variation. We'd all see something different because that's the way it tends to work.
Mm-hmm.
We don't hallucinate collectively. That's movie talk. That's not reality. So the question is, what did we experience? Why did we experience? Okay, that now, since that event happened, white families have lived in the house, black families lived in the house, Hispanic and Asian families, all of them independently of each other had similar experiences, apparitions, banging noises, things appearing and disappearing, lights going on and off, disembodied voices. So, I mean, what does that suggest? I mean, what did we see attack me? What happened to Dwayne? It merely makes you wonder. And we may never know. That's the problem. Because our knowledge base doesn't give us, we can't even speculate. Oh, so what, a spirit, a ghost took him over and caused us to see an apparition of a dead man that none of us even knew existed before? I don't know. That case was the, and of course the very first case was in 1968. A couple in Pasadena, elderly couple, their cat died and they were seeing and hearing their cat. And I went, yeah, right, okay. I didn't say it to them. So I'm interviewing them and, and I love cats. I'm not a dog person. I'm a cat person. And suddenly something jumps on my lap. I feel the paws. I feel it kneading my thighs. And I'm like, what? But I can't see it. But I can hear it. I can't touch it. But it can touch me. Then it leaves my lap and jumps on the couch, and the couch depresses to my left. And then it went away. So what did I experience? And they go, see? So what was happening?
It sounds like reality shifted a little bit.
Well, I mean, is it that my presence in there acted as an amplifier and I helped animate that what was there? We don't know. In the book, I talk about something what I call bio-holographic animation. Bio because we're the animator. Our brains, our living animated brains and consciousness are bringing this to life. Holographic because it's 3D and it's animated. We're the ones running the DVD, but we're the ones playing the DVD of the reality. We're the playback mechanism. It's stored, not in us, it's stored in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm convinced that this is going to be proven, but it's going to take time, money, and risk. And there is no money. There's all the time in the world. And risk is something you never put people in if you're conducting an experiment, unless you're immoral and unethical, which, of course, we're not.
Yeah, well, I guess it would have to take somebody who was either immoral and unethical or somebody that's basically signed their sanity away to say, look, whatever happens, happens. But nobody else would want to subject them to that because it's, like you said, it'd just be wrong.
Yeah, in the 2005 and 6 cases, which is mentioned in Chapter 7, the Cielo Drive case, I'm not a masochist. I don't want to hurt myself or anyone else. I'm not a sadist. And I went there 16 times because we were learning more there than I'd ever learned anywhere before. It was sort of a conglomeration of everything we've ever known in one place at one time. It's everything in the same place, minutes away from where I live. And I thought, and it turns out that Benedict Canyon has a very high clustering of haunting activity in it, including the old house Superman used to live in, George Reeves.
Right.
Which is very close to where this house
and died in.
Right, exactly. Which has never been solved except by Jan Ellen Henderson in his book called Speeding Bullet. But it's there's a lot of haunting activity there. And, it's an ancient Indian, not a burial site, a sacred ground. Maybe there is something unique there. And there's an earthquake fault underneath Benedict Canyon that hasn't been active, geologically speaking, in recent history, but there's a fault line under it. What a surprise.
Yeah, that's interesting you bring this up and mention this, because last week I told Richard Sennett, that and maybe let's see if you have the same take on it he did. I lived in a house in not Topanga, Beverly Glen.
Okay.
On Beverly Glen.
That's the same general area as Benedict Canyon, yeah.
Yeah, and apparently I think Elkie Summer lived in a house she said was haunted on that road.
Mid-60s. Yeah.
So in the 80s, the mid to late 80s, or actually, yeah, around the mid-80s I lived there in a house, and one time I walked into the kitchen, and I was the only person home, and the doors were closed. All the drawers in the kitchen were opened. But the thing was, they weren't opened in, you know, in some random fashion. There were, you know, three or four drawers on either side of the sink. They were opened like stairs. So the lowest one was open the most, middle one was open a little bit less, and the top one was open just a tiny bit. And I the funny thing was, I walked in the kitchen and I said, oh, that's strange. And then I looked around the house to make sure there was nobody around, and I thought, oh, I wonder if something's going on in this house. And Richard had a
That was the only incident?
No, the other funny thing, and it came up in your book, strangely enough, was the sounds of something running around in the walls and scratching.
Yeah.
I had that too, and I thought there was just some, you know, we were in Beverly Glen, we're basically in the canyon there, right up against the hill, there were no houses behind. I thought just some animal had gotten in, and maybe that's what it was, but... It made very loud scratching sounds, like louder than you. And I could put my hand up on the wall, and I could feel it. And if I put my ear to the wall.
You were living there alone? You had
I had one room or two roommates, but these roommates weren't home at the time.
Okay.
And they never experienced any of this stuff, or they never told me about it.
And how old were you at the time?
I was in my mid-20s.
And their ages were about the same?
Yeah, around my age, yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's certainly possible that any one of you... See, a lot of people can be seizure-prone and never even know it. People go through their whole life being seizure-prone, never being kindled to have a seizure because it takes a certain set of conditions for the body to react that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be the geomagnetic forces there was driving one of your bodies, triggering this event from one of you.
Yeah, maybe. I can't remember. I think some of the others heard the noise in the walls. Like I said, I could feel the scratching, and if I put my ear to the wall, I could hear noises like an animal was making some kind of squeaky noises. But it was a very small squeak and a very large scratch.
Yeah.
So I don't know what
that
was.
Number of cases, yeah.
So I don't know what it was. I mean, it never harmed me, anything like that. And he said, were you in some kind of... what was it, under some kind of stress. He said, I bet it was a romantic stress. I said, yes, it was, actually. There was...
Yeah, any stress can trigger it.
Yeah. And it was a high degree of it, because it was basically an unrequited love thing that had gone on for like 6 or 7 years. And I finally just realized it was just not going to happen, and I was very frustrated with that. And he said, well, maybe that's what was going... But he had guessed that beforehand. He just said, was it a romantic thing? I said, yes, it was. There was something like that going on.
There's a million things that produce stress in people.
Yeah.
You know, bad relationships, work, health, family, your carb screwed up or blew up on you, financial problems, whatever. And and if you're prone to this, and if you're in an environment that's conducive to it, as we're saying, that may be the recipe in order for this to occur.
Yeah, and the guy, the caretaker, said other people had complained about stuff in that house and in other houses, because I guess there was one owner that owned a few of the houses up and down Beverly Glen there. He said there was another house where socks and money kept appearing everywhere, pennies and nickels and things.
It's always pennies. I don't know what this was, pennies.
Maybe it was pennies, and he said that he found out, and I did not tell him the stuff was going on in the house. He just started telling me, and this was after the fact, too. And he said that they found out there was an old, the woman that used to own the place was very old, and she lived underneath the stairs, and she saved all these, she had like jars and jars and jars of coins that people had found when they'd moved in. And of course, they'd taken the coins out and took them to the bank or whatever, but then coins would keep appearing in drawers. Not on shelves or anything. He'd clean out the house, and there'd be one penny in each drawer every time he went back. And sometimes while he was there, he'd take a penny out, go back later, and there'd be another one there.
Interesting. We had a case in Van Nuys in the early 70s where they were finding thousands of dollars floating down from nowhere.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that in the book.
Yeah, and I said, are you troubled by this? They go, what do you mean? Are you telling the IRS? They go, no. I go, then what's the problem? I say, can we move in?
Yeah, exactly. I guess it ended eventually.
Yeah, it eventually ceased. Yeah, there were other phenomena linked to it, apparitions, things being thrown at people. It was a relatively interesting case, and then it abruptly stopped. And this is in chapter one of my book.
Yeah.
You know, called The Haunting Thought.
Yeah, most of the stuff we're going to talk about tonight is in the book. I got some questions off your website, too.
Yeah.
Let's see. It's funny because I have these questions. We're jumping around. Oh, I had a question about the RV program. You said that some of the stuff that was going on at UCLA was used as part of the RV program, and then there was some discussion about the program and its legacy and what many people thought of it and studies done afterwards. Initial contribution from the UCLA Parapsychology Lab?
Well, we developed some of the initial protocols and methodologies that were later refined and used at Epic SRI. UCLA had no interest whatsoever of becoming involved in this program because it would have been political suicide then and now.
Yeah.
So they didn't go to us. They went up SRI, and then dealt with the military and the intelligence community.
Right.
And that's what happened. You know.
What do you think about the RV program, and what do you think about the legacy, and what happened afterwards? The studies that were done about the RV program.
I think it's real. The phenomena works, unquestionably. We don't know why it works. We don't know how it works. Theoretical. We don't know how light fails occasionally, but there's a lot of noise in the system. And the real problem is that the mechanism is unknown to us, like I said, which is why the reason the government went to such great lengths to debunk it was to make sure that any future enemies or current enemies didn't use such technology against us. You there?
Yeah, I'm here. I don't think the government debunking it would stop anybody if they thought it was, personally,
the government's not the brightest bulb in the drawer, you know. They think, well, if we make this look like it's a big experiment in futility and stupidity, where we were chasing our own ignorance, people will ignore us.
Yeah, well, I think, to my mind, it had a lot to do with, that's what people wanted to hear. A lot of people in the military and in the civilian world, when they heard that, the academic world probably wanted to hear that. Mm-hmm. I've talked to four or five different people that were Lynn Buchanan, Joe McMonagle, David Morehouse, and a couple others that were in the program. I've interviewed them over the years, and every one of them basically said the same thing. They said it didn't work all the time, but it worked a lot more than it was supposed to. We got some good information. We got a bunch of junk, but we also got a lot of good information, and it seemed like a viable thing. And they were kind of mystified they weren't mystified. They said that a certain faction had come in and just didn't want to hear it, and they shut it down.
Well, religious zealots, you know, that happens.
Yeah, I think that was part of it, too. And then did you ever meet Ingo Swann, or was he away from you?
No, never met him.
Huh. What do you think of his research and his stuff? Because what they claim, and what the Jim Schnabel's book claimed, is that that he was basically the one provided most of the protocols and most of the ways that they did things in the program.
He started things. He was one of the, I guess, provocateurs, I would say, initiators of it all.
Yeah.
And the brilliant, it was an interesting character, to say, a very colorful character.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very unique individual.
Yeah, well, he's still alive. At some point, I wanted to meet him, but he's getting up in years.
Yeah, it's very bizarre, the whole thing. You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. The problem with all of this is, in the end of the day, The government went to great lengths. They hired professionals to be debunkers to reevaluate the statistics on the remote viewing program to make it appear as if nothing happened. Why? So any enemies won't use it against us. There's no way to shield against this. There's no way to prevent, put up, it's unlike science fiction. You can't do something that we know of to stop it from working.
Lynn Buchanan claimed to me that he had something, an object that he could put in the environment that seemed to block it, but that's the only time I've ever heard something like that.
Yeah, I doubt that. I mean, in terms of some kind of geomagnetic disruptor that prevents the consciousness itself of the living people from working to be that coherent, maybe, but in terms of something science fiction-like, I'd say no.
But it still goes on, I think. Oh, that's another question I had for you. Do you think it still goes on covertly or privately or anything like that?
Well, privately, who knows? I mean, I'm sure some people do it. But there have been a lot of people on talk shows, I won't use their names, and Joe McMonagle is not one of them, who've made some ridiculous claims about who and what they remote viewed. And the bottom line with all of this is, if you're not able to objectively verify the remote viewing event, it's worthless.
Yeah.
It's that simple. It's utterly worthless.
Oh, that you know what? That leads me to another question here. And it came up, you know, on what I'd read in the past and what I read in your book on your website.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the idea that you just mentioned. It seems like there has to be some sort of a closed loop there, which was why the remote viewers, when they were first testing them, they would give them the double-blind envelope, and then they would take them to the spot to show them what they were attempting to view. And I asked McMonagle, other people, about this, and they said, well, it seems to be you're sort of looking into your own future, and if you get that feedback later, you're basically closing that loop. Perhaps.
Uh-huh. That's one way. I mean, the thing is, it's important for everyone to realize, just because someone is psychic, they're gifted, that they can do this, doesn't mean they know how it works. It's like, I used to race cars professionally. I know how to build a race. I know how internal combustion engines work. 99.99% of the people that drive a car every day of their life have no idea how it works, and they couldn't tell you how to build one, or they couldn't rebuild it.
Yeah.
And when it comes to this area, this is the same sort of thing. There's all these theories and speculation. The only models that fit are holographic consciousness and space-time. But there's a lot of problems with that, because that implies that the future is controlled and unviable as the past is. It's sort of like we're all... I had an interesting guest on one of my shows the other night, Dr. Roger Nelson from the Princeton Engineering.
From PEAR,
And the Global Consciousness Project.
Right.
And a great, really brilliant man, very did some great work, and I pushed him to publish a book. And there's good evidence suggests that we as a human race are cognizant of things happening before they do, but we don't act upon them because they're at a very subliminal level.
Right.
And the question is, could we hone this process of this technology to where we know events before they occur that we could act to intervene?
Right.
The question is, could we intervene? And I told him in my book, I mentioned this instance where, okay, I'm a pilot. When I was younger and had more money and better vision, I used to fly. So I know a lot about aircraft. Had I been taller and had better vision, I would have gone in the Air Force. But that didn't work out. Anyway, in 1975, I had a dream. I was flying a 747. I was on approach to South Africa. Don't ask me how I knew that. And the plane was TWA, and I could guess that because it was red and white. So we're on final approach, and the turbofans go silent, and the instruments go dark. And I went, oh, my God. And then we drop like a lead balloon, and we explode. And I come flying out of bed, shaking, you know, hyperventilating. Oh, my God. And I thought, did some research the next day. 747 had never crashed. They were relatively new in service. And a few days later, the first 747 crashed on approach to South Africa. It was a TWA. So I didn't know what day, what month, what year, what time, what flight number. So what do? If it happened today and I called FAA, I'd be in jail.
Yeah.
The Homeland Security and the FAA, I would have been here with an hour with guns drawn, probably 5 minutes with guns drawn. Another instance I talk about in the book, just because, again, misinterpreting what we see is very common. This was in 1970. I met a girl in college, and taking classes with her named Sharon, beautiful blonde, and looked like Jane Krakowski, very attractive. And we got along, and we were dating, and then I started having these horrible dreams. And the dreams were that I'm driving to her house with her in the car. Now, I'm in the back seat. I didn't see me. I thought it was me driving. I saw her in the passenger seat. I didn't really notice what car we were in. I thought it was mine. And we turn down a cul-de-sac to go to her home, and we have a horrible accident. The large, dark blue vehicle or black vehicle hits us head-on. Horrible accident. And I kept having the dreams, and I said, I'm not going to risk your life. I told her, I can't date you anymore. She goes, you're just lying. You just want it. You live far away. I go, no. I said, I'm not going to do it. Well, I stopped seeing her thinking the problem's solved. She started dating someone else. The accident happened, but with him driving. Everything was the same, except I wasn't at the wheel. I didn't change the future. I just incorrectly thought.
Oh, well, this takes out the closed loop. Well, you did hear about it later, so. But the thing is, you said it was very detailed.
The driver died.
Yeah.
The girl who I knew did not, but she was badly injured and she never was quite the same. Did I change the future? We have no way of knowing.
Yeah, well, it brings to mind, this was in Radin's book about, because as you know, him and other people have done these presentiment things where people will react to something a split second before it actually happens.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And he was saying, well, is there a practical use for this? Maybe, perhaps, and it was the airplane thing again. What if you could hook everybody up somehow, an autonomic nervous system monitor to everybody on the plane, and if you get some kind of spike, that maybe that something can be avoided.
But the problem is most people won't react. That's the problem.
Yeah.
They won't even be aware of it because their brain has been trained to ignore it.
Yeah, well, he said that it took their conscious... the autonomic nervous system, it takes their conscious awareness out of it, because what they had found is that something with the heart rate, the blood pressure, and all that would change right before something happened in a great majority of people that he studied, enough that he thought it was almost normal. But my question mm-hmm. for him was, well, if somebody reacts to something that then doesn't happen, what were they reacting to? And his
they were hysteria, fantasy, panic, anxiety attack.
Yeah, but if you take the stimulus away that's having them, you know, react, or a lot of people react, what was it? And he said, well, in that case, I would say that you've just gone from one rail of possibility to another, if you look at it as a series of infinite possibilities and stop thinking of it in a linear way.
That's like, well, that's getting false positives. You're getting too many false positives. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but if the thing didn't happen, how do you know whether it's, you know, if they've avoided it or if it's a false positive?
You never know.
Yeah, exactly.
You never know. I don't subscribe, as my book talks about, the alternative realities, like branching, because there's no evidence for that. Maybe at a quantum level, but at the level we live at, there's no evidence that that occurs. We all remember the same past, generally speaking.
Right, right.
And we all remember this, you know, there's no different in the future. We may differ on our opinions of it, but we all remember it pretty much the same.
Yeah, I think what the idea was is that what we all remember is what's in the time stream or the causality stream that we reside in. Mm-hmm. There could be an infinite mm-hmm. number of possibilities in any direction, but you're always only aware of the one that you're in, and everybody else is aware of it too.
Well, that's like the old thing, the time travel. If you travel through time and come back to where you just left, you come back. You can't come back to that same reality because you were gone. You come back to another version of that reality.
Right.
Okay, it's science fiction, and we can't prove, we can't disprove it.
Oh.
Well, so it's a little different. I'm convinced that, as I wrote about in the third section of the book about space-time consciousness and the paranormal, that this can all be instrumented, that we can actually do tests of it, but it's going to make us redefine and reevaluate who and what we are as human beings.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of one of the questions I had. You know, what what's going to change people, you know, the mass opinion, or the at least the academic and media opinion about all this. And I don't think it's going to come from revising our theories the way they are, but it's going to come from some completely new view and some completely new way of looking at ourselves and how we relate to each other, we relate to our past and our future and the physical world.
Well, the reason, okay, as far as the media is concerned, it's all a joke anyway, because you have to understand, this is in the book, I think it's in the introduction,
yeah,
that, you know, the news isn't the news. The news is exaggerated, hyped, embellished, it's exaggerated to basically get ratings. It's been ratings for decades now. So what we're hearing may not be that precise. It's amplified for effect to get people to watch the news.
Yeah.
And therefore, if the media, the news people go, we're lying to the public to get their attention, to get ratings, so we get more money, they won't believe anything they hear from anybody. That's why most journalists, media people, are so skeptical, because they know they're lying to us, so that means everyone else is lying too.
Okay, but what about the other side of the equation, the academic community that determines what is real and what is not, what theories are holding sway right now? What would it take to change that?
The reason parapsychology hasn't gotten major funding except in the military or the intelligence community for a while was you can't control people's behavior with it yet. You can't make a lot of money with it yet for the most part. You can't kill people with it yet for the most part. So what good is it? I mean, that's how, you know, again, it's
right.
I mean, they have some, when I was in college, in high school, most of the programs that exist today, no one thought of them. And they have these ridiculous programs that it's like, what? I won't even say what they, I don't want to, you know, upset anybody. But the most ridiculous, you're getting degrees in something that have no relevance to anything in life other than the media's preoccupation with a certain element.
Right.
You know, when I was in school, people went to school to become doctors, lawyers, or engineers, or scientists, or teachers. And now a lot of kids, all they want to be is entertainers, which is a dead end.
Yeah.
The chance of you making a living off entertainment is the chance of you winning the lottery 3 or 4 times in a row at the $100 million level.
Yeah. Well, people don't realize that if they don't have talent,
right,
that kind of there's this idea that you don't need any talent, but that's
right.
You run up against
reality. And the other aspect is this. The gluttony of the litany of paranormal reality shows, which are in it, that's a misnomer in and of itself, an oxymoron. They're all the same, and they're all based on nothing, meaning nothing you see on the shows is real. It never has been. It never will be. Their job is in entertaining you, juvenile, moronic entertainment for people who don't know anything. And what they're doing is a tremendous disservice by misinforming the public to make them think what they're seeing on these shows is real, and it's not. I was approached by one of the early shows, or very early on, before it was even on, and by the creator, and I said, look, 99% of the time, 99.99% of the time, nothing happens. Well, we're going to fake it, and then when something does happen, we'll make it look like a hoax. I said, well, good inverted logic, but I can't be involved. I said, why? I said, I'm not going to throw my career away for what you're doing. I said, what house are you buying me? What car are you buying me? I said, well, we're not going to pay you. I go, goodbye. And they called me back for more shows. These people, I go, sorry. I mean, you know, if you're a producer and you're producing a paranormal reality show, you have a logistics problem. You can't have talking heads for 40 hours, 40 minutes out of an hour. It'll put people to sleep.
Yeah.
So you've got to either fake stuff, you've got to embellish what's on the screen to make it look more relevant than it is, or you have to the show has to be populated with some pretty colorful and strange people that are more interesting than the phenomena they're investigating.
Yeah,
and that's what's
well,
done. I wouldn't want to be in that. I mean, said, well, what works on camera? Nothing. Because most of the time, nothing happens. You know, did you feel that? Oh, did you hear that? Oh, did you smell that? Yeah, yeah, sure. You know?
Yeah, well, of course, fine.
They're all pretty much the same. It's depressing.
Well, what do you think would change this? What do you think? How long do you think?
Maybe people will get bored. I remember when Who Wants to Be a Millionaire came on. It was on one night a week, then 2 nights a week, then 3. Then it was on 7 nights a week and lasted for a couple of years, and it was gone. The paranormal, because all these different aspects of it, it's hanging on a little longer. Whether it's Bigfoot stuff or cryptozoology or ufology,
yeah,
it's just it's the same stuff over and over again. and it's not real. What they're seeing on TV is entertainment for people who don't think. And like I said in the book, you believe anything you see or hear on any of these shows, except for maybe a couple in cryptozoology, some of the good ones. I have a bridge I'd like to sell you that has a trillion barrels of oil trapped beneath its waters. And I go, what? You're not interested? You don't believe me? Why not?
Okay. Well, then maybe I should rephrase the question. What do you think? When do you think that would change, in so that people would be talking about it in the way that we are right now?
The problem is most people. Okay, if people don't know how the physical world around them works, how then can they know what exists beyond its boundaries? So before you know what's paranormal, you have to know what normal is and where normal ends. And that's the problem. If people don't know anything, they believe what they see. That's right. Why magic works well, because they realize their attention is being misdirected, and they're from the get-go, they're being made to look at something that's not real. Once they saw what it was, from that point on, they see the tricks and they ignore it.
Yeah,
so
of course.
Who knows what's going to happen? I'm shocked that the paranormal reality genre has survived this long. I thought it would have exhausted itself. But, you know, I guess it's cheap to produce because no one's paid for the most part. There's no, you know, there isn't like, no one's paying a screenwriter, and there aren't actors. And, you know, there's no SAG minimums or anything like that. And they're non-union, most of the shows. So it's a very cheap show to produce, by and large.
Well, then what it sounds like, actually, what we're talking about here, and answer my question, is kind of a chicken and egg thing.
Right.
You know,
at some point,
it's recursive with the stupidity of the time, or whatever you want to call it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can't really change that.
Yeah, some people, the bubble will burst at some point, and that'll be the end of it. And all right, been there, done that, what else is new?
Mm-hmm.
A couple of shows have been canceled pretty quickly because they were so outrageous. So, you know, people, let's push the envelope and make it really over the edge or over the top, and it's extreme paranormal or ghost lab, or, and it just, they're, you know, it's a joke. And I've got the best show they can make. You have a screen, there's nothing on it but white noise, visual white noise and audio white noise, and tell people their show's on. Guess what? People would see things in the noise. That's how our brain works. Our brain likes to order chaos or noise into order. That's the way we're designed to function. I guarantee, I'm surprised no one's done that. Or have a show called Bimbo Babe Ghost Hunters. You have a Playboy channel.
Yeah,
and bodacious babes running around in dog bikinis, going ghost, ghost, yeah, ghost, yeah, yeah, right. That would sell.
Yeah, that would do great.
And at the Playboy Channel, every man would watch it. You know, I did a show on Girls Next Door six years ago, and it was interesting. I got to meet Hefner and two girls that used to live with him, and
yeah,
there wasn't anything going on except that one of them was a poltergeist agent. And it was interesting. You know, the measurements around one of them, I think it was Bridget, was really intriguing because she had a history of this phenomenon, and her body was putting out up to 5 Gauss, which is extraordinary.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, once she moved out, things stopped because it was all around her.
Right.
It was nice meeting everybody, and it was fun, and they paid me a little money for my time, so I can't complain. And but, you know, the co-creator of the show called me, and he doesn't believe in this stuff at all. He said, I've got a case for you. I go, all right, where is it? He goes, no, really, what is it? It's a Playboy Mansion. Was it haunted by silicone? So he got to him. And so it's interesting. But, you know, I can laugh at some of the stuff if it's done right, if it's done well. But if it's done with the intent of misinforming the public, I lose interest in it very rapidly. And, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think the intent is misinforming the public. That's a byproduct.
Yeah. I mean, the paranormal activity movies are like, give me a... I saw the first one. I got a screener, and I saw it. And I was bored to death until the second half of the third act. And then it picked up, and I go, that's it? There was this beautiful brunette in the show, the lead female actress. And,
yeah.
And she goes to sleep in her clothing, so that was boring. And it was like, the movie was like, what's the point? I mean, I didn't see the second one or the third one because it's just the same thing over and over again.
I saw the second one. I saw the second one about 18 times. It was terrible.
18 times?
I worked at Technicolor Digital Cinema, and we had to do that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Watching it once was bad enough. I can't imagine. I mean, you know, you'd have to pay me huge money to watch it. It's so boring. It's so just unbelievably boring. You know, just watch you have a camera, watch paint peel. It'd be a lot more interesting.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt about it. It was very, very boring, badly done.
It's very creative.
Didn't make me think.
The people that did it were very creative. They were brilliantly inventive with regard to what they did. It tapped into the social consciousness, the zeitgeist at that moment, and they made a lot of money off them. And, you know, and great. I mean, for what they're doing, it works, but it's a gross misrepresentation of what's really going on. And see, once you get past all the garbage and all these stupid shows, both in movies and television, there's an extraordinary volume of material and data out there that is absolutely amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And but the question is, you know, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, but you have to take the time to absorb the information and roll it over in your mind come to some kind of conclusion about it and talk to people.
Because you can't have people talking in an hour. You can't have 40 minutes of talking heads. It'll put people asleep.
Yeah.
So what are you going to have on television? And people approached me recently for another show, a different group of people, and I said, what's going to be on screen? They wouldn't tell me. They go, so what's going to be happening? And they don't know. I mean, so what are you doing per show? They don't know.
They had money already?
I don't know. These people had some success in other areas. And I said, and you know, I couldn't work with them anyway because I'm doing other work in other areas that would have been conflicting with it.
Oh, okay.
But they wouldn't tell me what they're doing that would make this show viable on camera, that opposed to everything else that's out there.
Uh-huh.
I wish them luck. You know, I mean, who knows? There's certainly always room for more and different, and it's a joke. I mean, I've seen these shows on Bigfoot finding these people out there with the night vision, you know, cameras, and, oh, did you hear that? Oh, it must be a, oh, yeah, that's a Bigfoot calling me. Yeah, I know, they're calling me. Yeah, right, well, put a Bigfoot in camera, I'll be impressed with that. It's kind of boring. Now, there have been good shows on the History Channel with, like, Jeff Muldrum and some anthropologists who put some really good people on who really know what they're talking about and bring forth good evidence and data. That's great. But they said, oh, yeah, well, I hear he's calling. Yeah, they're calling me. There's a whole family. Yeah, they want me to go have dinner with them. Right. Dinner with them. Sure.
Yeah, the thing about those shows is Meldrum is a biologist.
He's a biological anthropologist. Or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, and
yeah, he's got a doc. Yeah, this is a very intelligent, articulate man.
Yeah.
And is very educated and knows of what he speaks and, you know, when you watch these shows, you're learning things. You're learning things about the real nature of the beast, so to speak.
Yeah. But the funny thing is that since he is that sort of a scientist, he's looking at from a, as far as I can tell, a purely physical viewpoint and theory. And to my mind, from all the things I've heard and the reports and what people have said, we're not looking at a purely physical thing. A lot of the time.
Well, I mean, it depends on who you're talking to. There's all sorts of, when it comes to cryptozoology, whether it's Loch Ness or mostly the Bigfoot, there's some people claim there's some link to ufology with Bigfoot. But I mean, you know, no one knows. I mean, we don't know. All we know is that if they had to make a bet, it is a potential missing link, and there is something, some element of the hominid species that broke off in a different way, and there's a small group of them that live around the world, and they stay away from humans.
Yeah, and nobody's ever found any remains or a grave or anything like that, which is kind of strange to me.
Well, I mean, look, you know, up until not long ago, no one found any evidence of giant squids, and now they found them. They've washed ashore. They caught them in fishing net. They've actually videotaped them under the water.
Right.
Yeah, but one colossal squid. But so now we know these giant squids aren't legend. They're real.
Uh-huh.
So,
a thing of more people paying attention to it, like you say.
Yeah, more evidence, more collection of data, more good research is done, and evidence comes up. When it comes to the paranormal, there was a book out in the summer by Annie Jacobson called Area 51 Declassified.
Oh, yes.
And it was just, what a bunch of, I mean, talk about disinformation. It was the biggest, I mean, with regard to what was going on at Area 51, the military, the Black Ops was a good book. The minute she got into the ufology, the book went south and it tanked. I won't even waste listeners' time, but on my website, barrytaft.net, one of the blogs is called Disinforming the Paranormal Ufology. I go into her book at great length, and in a nutshell, she said that, well, actually, it was the Russians that did this. They had the help of Dr. Joseph Mengele.
Yeah.
They engineered some kids to look like aliens, and they dropped a UFO-like object with these kids in looking to create a panic like Orson Welles' War of the Worlds. What? And there's so many holes in this theory, it's ridiculous. And this,
yeah.
This, it just, it, and this Annie Jacobson, when she went on the different talk shows, she went on all the talk shows,
yeah.
They tore her to pieces, rightfully so, because her theory, it's garbage.
Why? Yeah, you wrote about that, and maybe you can expand on it. Why do you think that was there? Why do you think that story was in there in the midst of all that other stuff?
Okay, I'd like to know who the parent company of the publisher, I think it is Little Brown.
Yeah.
I'd also like to know, there were 2-3 hours of primetime TV on the National Geographic Channel. One was called 2 hours when aliens attacked, and then another hour called Area 51 Declassified or something. And it was all dedicated to what Jacobson wrote. And for a government who's denied the existence of UFOs and aliens forever, why they supposedly have, you know, contingent plans in case we're invaded by evil aliens? It's ridiculous. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So why is there such a big push right now to lie to the public about these topics? Why now? What don't they want us to pay attention to now? And that's what I'm looking at. You know, disinformation works several ways. One way is you have the truth surrounded by a lot of lies. When the lies surrounding the truth are discovered, the truth is thrown out with the lies, or the inverse. You have a lie surrounded by a lot of truth, and then when the lies discovered, the truths surrounding it are thrown out with it. And I think Jacobson's book could be a little bit of both. And this is the way it works.
Yeah.
And disinformation. And it's, you know, I get a lot of the public, in the scientific community, I can see why they get frustrated and like, what's the point? The people in this field are nuts. They're uneducated. A lot of them are crackpots. You know, you don't need disinformation agents from the government going out. You have enough crazy people in this field already. We don't need it. We don't need anyone's help. I mean, in the book, I talk about, I think it was in the introduction, I met a girl in 87. We had a MUFON, Mutual UFO Network support group in L.A.,
yep.
And we were dealing with the fallout of Whitley Strieber's book, Communion.
Right.
So we're having the meeting, and this woman's there, and this girl's there, and she's talking about her alleged abduction. I didn't believe her.
Uh-huh.
This woman sounded like she had some problems, and they weren't because of abductions. She had psychiatric problems. So I thanked her for her time. That was it. Years later, I'm online, and I see she had a blog she wrote about me. She said, she knew instantly upon meeting me that I was sneaky and underhanded. Okay. I was untrustworthy. Okay. I instantly hypnotized her and gained control of her mind. And then, and then I went home and used psychotronic weapons I have hidden in my basement to direct evil psychic entities to rape her as she walked up and down streets. And I used her as the basis for the Entity movie. I go, what? Wait. The Entity Move case was 74, the book was 78 and 9, the movie came out in 83, I met this woman in 87. So what's wrong with this picture? Little temporal discontinuity?
Yeah.
The woman's nuts. She's clearly psychotic. And I've run into this over and over again. I met a woman, I dated this girl in the 70s named Linda. You know, didn't work out. I bumped into her about 13 years ago in a lecture I was giving with Barry Conrad's. And so she showed up. She looked great. No lines, no wrinkles, no fat. Really nice. And she introduced her to Barry Conrad, and she said, I need your help. I go, with what? She goes, well, I need your help because the CIA and the FBI have conspired with demonic aliens to take over the world. You got to help me. And I went, oh, God. Help me in Jesus Christ. I go, look, I've got to go. My so on the way back, Mary's going, I thought you didn't date with crazy women like that. So when I knew her, she wasn't crazy. Okay. Then she keeps calling and calling. I said, look, I don't want to have this discussion. You need psychiatric help. I said, you sound suicidal. And she did try to commit suicide. Not long thereafter, she failed. And she tried again. She failed. They let her go. And then she stayed away for a while. The last time I heard from her was early 08. She called. Her name was Linda. It's Linda. She says, I need your help. I go, what is it now, Linda? She goes, the earth is about to explode. I went, oh, really? And I couldn't pass up the opportunity. So I said, excuse me, Laura. I've got to send baby Kal-El off to his new homeworld before Krypton explodes. You're insane. And I hung up the phone. And she probably went, Krypton? Kal-El? What are you talking about? And that's in my book. So these are the kind of crazy people I meet.
Oh, I got a message from one of the listeners here.
Okay.
He wants to ask a question. It asks, could you please ask Dr. Taff if he's heard about the bizarre happenings that occurred on the set of The Entity during the filming? I think you did.
Let's just say that most of what he read is total exaggeration. It's either fabrication or fantasy. I was there most of the time. Nothing out of the ordinary happened. The only thing happening was the director went kind of crazy and kind of went nuts, and I won't get in. That's in the book. And there were a lot of fights with the director and the executive producer, and they didn't like myself or my colleague at all. And it was a very unpleasant shoot for a number of reasons. And production was very difficult. And he might have been talking about when David LaViosa was pulled back on a wire to simulate the phenomenon of throwing him back. He re-broke his arm. Well, accidents happen all the time when making movies. Nothing paranormal about that. Things happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's life. The only person on the cast that was pleasant to us was Ron Silver. He was very nice, very friendly, got a good sense of humor, very, very affable. Barbara Hershey, don't bother me, I'm an actor. Yeah, okay, Barbara. And the woman who played Dr. Cooley, black name was Brooks. Nice, but didn't want to talk. The guy who played me, Richard Brestoff, other than coaching him in some particular dialogue, he could care less. It just, you know, they're actors. They're not there to have an interest in the subject matter.
Right.
So, but other than that, the only problems, real problems, are with the director and the I'll say, crazy executive producer. He's passed away, so, no big deal. And I talk about this in the book, by the way.
Yes.
About the problems in making the movie, and it wasn't a pleasant event. I've been on a lot of movie sets that I've worked on over the years. This is one of the least pleasant for a number of reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, it does go into detail. So that was Carlos that asked the question. I ordered the book on Amazon and thoroughly enjoyed it. I think you will, too. Later in the book, because of the title, Aliens Above, Ghosts Below, we've been talking mostly about the ghost and paranormal stuff. What moved you to write a couple? There's two or three chapters in there specifically on UFOs, abductions, related things.
Right. Okay. Well, if you did a lot of research in ufology and read a lot of books from qualified researchers, you know the name Dr. Jacques Vallée, and he's published probably 10 or 12 books. And Your Passport to Magonia, The Invisible College. He was one of the first to saw a correlation between paranormal experiences and ufological, that they seem to be very much related, although we're not explaining one with the other, although my guess is whatever UFOs are, even if they are technology from interstellar beings coming here, they would use forces they might use their forces the way we use electromagnetism, and the forces they use are beyond our comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a number of cases that began as poltergeist outbreaks turned into abductions, Chapter 10 called Abduction Central. This is an event that altered my life. It's also in my website called A Life-Changing Paranormal Event. I met a beautiful girl on a case in 1977, one of the most stunning women I've ever seen. She looked like the deceased actress Marie Blanchard when she had dark hair. I mean, I dropped dead gorgeous. My exact stereotype. So we got involved, started dating. Everything was fine. The paranormal, okay. met her on a poltergeist investigation.
Which yeah.
her belief in ufology was zero. Anyway, everything was great. Emotionally, physically, sexually, intellectually, it was perfect. And we met on Valentine's Day, and I said about 2 months into it, I started having these dreams. The dreams were that the relationship ended on July 22nd. And I go, oh, no. I didn't tell her. I didn't know why, or just knew that's what happened. Wrote it down. Anyway, make a long story short, because we're closing in on the end of the show. On July 22nd, we wake up. I was staying in her condo with her at that time, and she's under the cover. She won't come out, and she's sobbing, and she said, why didn't I help her? I go, help you with what? When they took me, I go, what are you talking about? She said the room lit up in the middle of the night. She found herself being levitated out of bed, found herself in a round metal room, strapped to a table, that her neck, her ankles, her wrists, and her abdomen. There were these little guys around her with no hair, these big black eyes, no outer ears, no nose, a slit for mouth. They looked like snakes, reptilian. They were touching and probing and cutting her, and they were hurting her. And they kept saying, don't worry, we're not going to hurt you. And I said to her, do you know anything about UFO abductions? And remember, this is before Close Encounters came out. She goes, what, with UFO what? What are you talking about? She had no interest or belief. Okay, I finally coaxed her out from under the covers. She's bleeding from her ear, bleeding from her eye, bleeding from her nose, bleeding from her rectum, and bleeding from her uterus, and she wasn't menstruating. Around her ankles, her wrist, her abdomen, her neck were black and blue constriction marks. Her hair had been cut. There were scooped out chunks in her back like pieces of skin, like a melon baller. She had a breakdown, complete breakdown, and she went nuts. Never recovered. And had that not occurred, whatever it was, we would have been married within probably a year. Now, I've talked with her since then. She's a complete space cadet in ways too boring to get into during the book. And occasionally she claims to have been re-abducted. Now, what lends support to what I believe happened is that night some people in that part of L.A. Hello?
Yeah.
What was that?
Well, there's sirens going by, so every once in a while I'll turn the microphone down so those won't come through.
What happened, so that night people around where she lived saw this large glowing object, like a reddish orange, hovering over that part of L.A. Okay? And the power in the house had gone out, well, not in the house, in that area had gone out for a couple hours, which could have been coincidental. So, was she abducted? Maybe. Why didn't they take me? I wouldn't take me. I don't know why they took her. I don't know,
Well, the thing about this was it happened, as you say, before any of this stuff became common knowledge.
Yeah, in 1977, you said abduction, people would think, by criminals. And, those of us in ufology knew about it, and I did. We had another case. Okay, now, the reason I say they wouldn't take me is, it's somewhat comical, but we don't know what these beings are, where they're from. I suspect there's more than one culture coming here from more than one different star system. I don't think it's one just group, because there's all different types that have been reported throughout time and throughout different periods of different parts of the planet. My guess is they intimidate people through fear. They have to manipulate and control people. If I was abducted, I would say, you tell me how the ship flies. What's the power source? What is avionics? Well, how do you navigate? What's the propulsion technology? That's the last thing they want. So I wouldn't take me. I don't know. But then again, let's go to another case.
Yeah.
A little later than that, an executive from a network, I won't say which one, poltergeist manifestation, go to his house, meet his wife, and we never saw anything, but they were very upset, and then it stopped. And then not by 6 months later, they're taking a trip up north in California. They're driving, and they saw it was a plane crashing. This is in the book. They go up in the hills, and they turn around a bend in this canyon, and they see this object sitting on the ground, disc, these little humanoids outside doing things. And suddenly one of them looked at them in the car, pointed a tube or metallic rod that popped with light. They blacked out, and they found themselves suddenly driving 80 miles away. They didn't even remember this for many weeks. Then they started getting nightmares and horrible memories and getting angry and bitter at each other. Their marriage, he couldn't hold a job. That was that. We had a number of cases like this. Normal, stable people who have no interest in the subject matter whatsoever. And it tears them apart. The question is, why? I mean, we know that in abduction, there is paranormal fallout in some cases. I suspect that the forces being used by whatever's visiting here alters us in a way that we don't currently understand. And that's probably why this happens. Why they pick certain people, I don't know. But to me, I don't think our government or any Western government would dare reveal what they know on this subject matter because it's too dangerous. If we have trouble getting along with white and red and yellow, black and brown, you know, just black and white, for, you know, in our own cultures, what if we add a gray to the mix? I don't think that would work. And then if, what if we discovered that we have an inconceivable past and unimaginable future? What if we discover that we, meaning the human race, was engineered by another race of beings who are not God? And we're the result of that experiment. And my book talks about evidence to support this.
Yeah, your model in the book seems to be the extraterrestrial hypothesis.
Right.
Is that the one you've settled on?
Yeah. Pardon?
Have you settled on the extraterrestrial hypothesis as what you think is the most likely?
It's more complicated than that, because if they can travel over the very many light years in real time, that means they're moving through time as well as dimensions. So it's a lot more complicated than the idea of us going somewhere in a ship. It's not simply nuts and bolts technology. They have the power to affect matter, energy, and mind, which is beyond anything we can comprehend. So we're like rats in a lab to them. And I got this weird feeling that if this was brought to the attention of the world, it would be utter chaos. And the world's governments, let's say our own government, exists on a basis of a couple of things. One is domestic tranquility. So come April 15th, we write that damn check. And if domestic tranquility fails due to war, chaos, economic, socioeconomic collapse, the checks don't come in anymore. That's all the government cares about. 1938, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast on radio. That terrified the entire country. If that was repeated in reality, there'd be mass panic. And then we got religions, the ones we know of and we're familiar with here, and ones we're not that familiar with that we're already fighting in different parts of the world. I don't think they would take very kindly to this sort of information because we can't get along with each other the way we are, and adding this to the mix would only make it more difficult. So my guess is opening that can of worms is something the government would be better off not doing. Few people would benefit from it, and we might live to see the disintegration of government anyway because of the economy. I got a real bad feeling we're going to be in a depression within less than 2 years, within a year. I mean, the way things are going, it's really scary. The fact that no one seems to be able to do anything because they're too busy making money. But the UFO, there's more evidence with regard to ufology than there is for any topic of the paranormal. Some really good books written by Richard M. Dolan, UFOs and the National Security State, Volumes 1 and 2, the most comprehensive text ever published regarding how the government has manipulated social consciousness through media to dissuade us from believing in ufology, and that our history was very perhaps much shaped by this, that a lot of our deity beliefs and may have come from this, you know. So it's a problem.
Well,
go ahead.
I was going to say, if you listen, some of the shows and some of the things I've written about, my conclusion, tell me what you think of this, is that people in the government aren't quite sure what they're dealing with. They don't know. They think it might come from another planet, but they don't know how to control it, and they don't know exactly what it is. And that's what the cover-up is, not that there are aliens coming from other planets and taking people's DNA. No, I think it's just that they think they might know what's going on, but they're not exactly sure. And the most important thing is they don't know what to do with it.
I agree, but I think scope of this is well be talking about. I think there is a linkage to our heritage, to our genetic makeup. And if we owe our existence to this stuff, it would be really difficult for people to adjust to that. That's what I, that's my, and this is referenced in my book over and over
again. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'd read it. That's why
I was
asking.
But even
about...
then, they may not know, we, meaning governments, may still not know who they are or where they're from. They just know they're here. There's been a limited forms of contact. And, you know, like, let's give the dumb animals some cheese and see what they'll do. You know, let's give them some toys and see if they relate to it. Who knows, you know? Who knows?
There's
I don't
also...
know. That's,
go ahead.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of discussion in the book of what could I say? Well, about how these things could possibly get here, and based on latest advances in physics, and a lot of it made sense. But the thing that really struck me was you said you had attended a commencement address at UCLA for the engineering school with, I think it was Ben Rich.
Yes, UCLA alumni. And he gave a talk, and the famous phrase that's been repeated to death is that we have things flying to Groom Lake that would make George Lucas drool. So afterwards, as the crowd thinned out, I went up to him. I said, well, tell me, sir, is Mr. Rich, goes, Ben, okay. Tell me, Ben, is what you're describing, did you create it or did you acquire it? And he goes, what? I said, did you create it or did you acquire it? He goes, what do you think? I think the latter. He goes, you might be right.
Do you choose to believe that, or do you think that he was just screwing around with you just to make you think?
He was rather shocked by what I said because no one else addressed this in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
So... it was very different, and this is a real straight shooting guy. He was kind of caught off guard by it. I think there has been recovered technology, but I don't think we've been able to put it to use. I mean, there is suggestions now by Richard Dolan and a few others that there has been a secret space program for years that goes way beyond anything we know of, the space shuttle, the Apollo program, the internet that we have. Like, one of the things on my website, one is called, Come Fly With Me, The Last Plane Standing. And it's all about, for the most part, the Aurora hypersonic spy plane that replaced the SR-71. This thing has been flying for 20 years and a little more. And it makes the space shuttle look like junk. It takes off like a jet, goes into orbit, and then lands again. And it flies up to Mach 18. But it hasn't been formally acknowledged. Why? It's a delivery. It's a weapon system. It's a reconnaissance vehicle. I don't think, if I had to make a guess, that we successfully reverse engineered alien technology to the point, if we did, then building jets, new bombers and fighters is worthless, because what do we need them for? What, to fight war? I mean, then I talk about the B-2, there's evidence that they use electrostatic charges on the hull, on the fuselage, to reduce drag coefficient, produce a wave riding function.
Uh-huh.
And I've read the patents I've downloaded to even support this. This isn't my contention. This is what the patents talk about. So it's, you know, I'm convinced that we know enough now to build a warp engine, a field propulsion warp engine, like in Star Trek. It could be done. It would take a lot of money and time, dedicated research in a controlled environment, but even if we had it, we had our Starship Enterprise in orbit right now, where do we go? We don't have anyone else's address. We just run around the universe hoping to find someone that wants to sit down and talk with us. My guess is, if we're having problems controlling the forces we already have, would you be willing to give a culture's primary occupation in trouble warfare technology that dwarfs thermonuclear power? I wouldn't.
But at some point, at a certain point in the book, you said you think that, according to Ben Rich and some other people and some hints, that we probably do have this capability.
I think we have the knowledge. I don't think it's been deployed. There have been people who claim that we've already been to the moon and Mars. We have these advanced space technologies. Well, great, but there's no proof one way or the other, so I'll err on the side of caution and say no. Yeah, I mean, there's all this theory they were being tested at Area 51 and other places. Alien research vehicles, ARVs, I don't know. All I know is that if you read my book, there's enough information to build a warp engine. You can't do this in your garage. You can't do it in your backyard. And let me give you an idea. Unlike what we see in movies and television, if the Enterprise was designed based on what I talk about and based on what's believed would work, that is rotating mercury plasmas and antimatter plasmas of mercury, which would cause frame dragging and torsion field frame dragging, if that annihilates, if the fields that contain it break down like in Star Trek, you don't have an explosion. To give you an idea, 1 kilogram of antimatter, if completely annihilated, has enough power to destroy the entire surface landmass of the North American continent and blow the atmosphere of it into space. That's 1 kilogram. Mm-hmm. We're talking of a few thousand kilograms in a controlled environment. The containment fails, the Earth and the Moon vanish in a bright light, and that's the end of it.
Which is probably, if the technology is available, why it hasn't been deployed. That's what you're saying.
Right. Well, it's dangerous. And also, theoretically, this could be used to travel in time. Because one application is moving space faster than normal, in which case you can warp, that's warp technology. The other is moving through time quicker by a different application of the same method. And, you know, the thing is, if you're in your time machine and you jump 10 years forward, you can't theoretically come back to the time you just left because you were there for 10 years. You might come back to a reality that's similar, but it's not your reality.
Yeah.
Back to that, this is all in the book. The whole notion of space and time, we're going to have to really think about what it is and what it means, because it's wrong. The way the logic we've been taught, it works for us at the physical level, but at the paranormal level or at this level, call it a zero-point level, it's wrong. It's only applicable to the body and physics we know of here. There's another level far beyond it that seems to be very much appropriate from moving through space faster. You're not moving through space. You're moving space by you. That's the secret.
Yeah, this has been described. In fact, it was described in a paper because I was always hammering against the ETH, but there was that mm-hmm. paper, the inflation theory implications for mm-hmm. I think it was interstellar travel or space travel.
Yeah.
You know about this paper, right? In a lot of technical language, which you have to read very carefully over and over again, at least for me, to understand, it explained, and you go into the same kind of information in your book, mm-hmm. how something, a sentient sort of consciousness being, well, physically, could go from one place to another and not have to worry about all the, you know, the normal laws that everybody knows about space travel with you know, chemical engines right. and acceleration and deceleration and right. Speeds and all that.
But you're not moving as we know movement. It's like, again, if you have an 8x10 piece of paper, you want to go from the low left to the high right, you don't just go. You cause those two, the space there to fold. You warp the space. Taking away the space, you take away the time.
Yeah, and the only
problem, frequently enough, you can go anywhere you want very quickly.
And the only problem I remember reading about that in your book and in this paper was it requires such vast amounts of power that theoretically it's possible, but practically it's not.
Well, that's true, but it's not true. This, trust me, the Enterprise can be built. And you've got to take a lot of power to kick it off. Once it's started, it's self-perpetuating. And it's like a self-sustaining process. It's far more powerful than fusion, than thermonuclear fusion. It's the Nazis were playing with this at the end of World War II. And it's been written up in the book called The Hunt for Zero Point and a few other books.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because if the war had lasted a few years longer, they would have won. And most people wouldn't be alive today. The world would have probably self-destructed long ago.
Well, there's another problem with that sort of travel, and you mentioned it before, that the whoever was traveling in the ship, whatever reality or place or whatever they came back to would be different. So basically they would have to abandon any connection they had to anybody or anything that they left.
Yeah, well, see, we don't know. No one's traveled in superluminal speeds.
Yeah,
so
okay.
It would be
theoretically.
You go and back, and no time goes for you at all, but you come back, and thousands of years have gone by, or is it instantaneous? No one knows. No one's done it yet that we know of.
Yeah.
And still, I think it's going to be different than we could even imagine. That's what I guess.
Right.
But my book covers all of this in great detail. So if you want to build a time machine, read the book. You want to build your own warp engine for your enterprise, read the book. It's all, and it all ties together with the paranormal. What it all links back to the same problem of a new form of energy that affects space, time, and consciousness.
Right, and you're coming at it from all these, as you mentioned in the book, all these different, like the three blind men and the elephant.
Right.
And the problem is to figure out what that elephant is.
Right, exactly. One person said, oh, holding the leg. Oh, it's a trunk. It's a trunk for a tree trunk. The other holds the tail and thinks it's the rope. The other holds the trunk and goes, oh, this is the hose. And they're all wrong. And this is where we're at. We're investigating the effect of an unknown cause. So you collect enough data, look for patterns, longitudinal patterns of the data, see if there's consistencies. There are consistencies. This is why I wrote the book after 43 years of work.
I really did enjoy the book, and I think we touched on probably 5% of what's in it if we're lucky. So.
Okay, well, if you want to have me back on, I'd be happy to come on again. You're a really good interviewer. We covered a lot of good material, and you're very knowledgeable, so it helps.
Well, I enjoyed it quite a lot, too. I mean, we didn't even get to the thing about the superliminal viewing system. We didn't talk about universe where all the events and locations are announced and distributed evenly and always accessible, et cetera, et cetera.
We did talk about
that a little bit,
the holographic space-time.
That's right. I wanted to get into that more, so yes, I will have you back here in the near future.
Okay, whatever works.
And we'll set up a time.
Very good host and intelligent, articulate guy for a change.
Well, thanks. And it's interesting talking to you and, reading your book and looking at your site, which I will link on the show when I put it up here in a day or so, got my brain working on a lot of stuff that I hadn't thought of in a long time. And it made me excited again. Kind of hard to do with me at this point. Thanks so much, Dr.
Okay.
Barry Taff. And we'll have you on again soon. And thanks so much for your time. And I'll send you an email when this show is posted.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye. There we go. Dr. Barry Taff. Like I said, we hardly got to... We got to a lot of parts of my questions here, but there's so many other things in the book and so many other things that we could talk about that we could get into, and we will on a future show. So keep on listening. I don't have any people scheduled, any guests for the next few weeks. So they will have Dr. Taff on again. I got a musical guest I think I've lined up here. We just have to figure out a date. And a bunch of other people, which have kind of been, we've been waiting in the wings on them, but I haven't contacted them yet. Oh, Peter Robbins' friend said that he would come and come on the show and talk about a very spectacular sighting of something he had in the middle of the night out over the desert there. Peter has assured me that the listeners will enjoy it and maybe be able to draw some conclusions from it. Who knows? Anyway, we'll have this gentleman on in the next few weeks. So thanks for listening. See you next week. And let's see if we get... I get so involved with talking to the guests that I don't get the music plugged in.
We've got extrasensory perception. It makes our love unique. There isn't any doubt or question when into your mind I can peek. Not with extrasensory perception, our love will grow and grow. You won't have to worry or wonder. Just look in my head and you'll know. You'll know the secrets that are in my heart. You'll know the reason and the rhyme. We'll be together when we're far apart. Baby, you'll be with me all the time. With extrasensory perception, our love will be refined. Since our affair had its inception, I can't get you out of my mind. There is no chance of a deception. How dull it's gonna be. Let's go find two normal people. Baby, stop thinking at me.
What was that you thought?